Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to Dyed Green. I'm your host, Max Sussman.
And I'm Kate McCabe.
The other host.
Our guest on today's show is a really inspirational artist and organizer named Katie Holton, an artist and an activist who is originally from Ireland but currently lives in New York City. Her work is inspired by the relationship between humans and the natural world. And one of her most recent projects is creating this incredibly beautiful book called The Language of Trees, a rewilding of literature and landscape that came out earlier this year. Katie created a tree alphabet that has a corresponding font. So each letter corresponds to a different living tree. She's made one for New York City and has also made an Irish tree alphabet.
We should get dyed green hats that are in the tree language. How cool would that be?
Or any kind of swag in tree.
Yeah. It would just say dyed green tree.
No, I know what you're saying.
It'd be sweet, right?
Yeah. Do you speak tree?
Birch, oak, aspen, walnut.
You know, that's actually one thing that actually is a question which I can't believe we forgot to ask Katie, and which now I will just never not be thinking of, is how do you pronounce the language of trees? Like when you're reading the font.
That's what I'm saying. You have to speak the name of the tree for each letter.
Mm. It's not some like guttural kind of language that comes.
No, Kate, it's an art project. Talking to Katie was great because the conversation was like sort of this overlap of art and environment and activism, which are all things that are really important to us. So it was wonderful to connect all those in the conversation.
I really like how Katie talked about the role of the artist in terms of getting involved in politics and speaking out. It's especially important in this time with the unfolding climate crisis. If you're going to be making art about nature, how could your art not actually speak to these existential questions? And how could you not live your life accordingly? Anyway, highly recommend the book. It's really beautiful. It's really interesting. And like I said to Kate, well, you can just listen to it yourself. I'm not going to tell you what I said because I said what I said and you got to listen if you want to know.
Thanks everyone for tuning in.
I've been looking forward to this conversation for a really long time. I'm very excited to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's lovely to finally meet.
I was hoping you could start out by talking a little bit about where you come from and how you came to be inspired by the relationship between people and nature and the role that that plays in your art.
Yeah. Well, I guess it all goes back to rural Ireland. I was born in Dublin, but my parents, and I'm the eldest, so I was the first baby. We moved to Longford, right in the middle of Ireland, as soon as I was born. So that, and we were there until I was 10. So the first 10 years of my life were spent, kind of running wild and free. Our house was on the edge of a field. And at the edges of that field were ditches and hedges with trees. So, and my mum's a gardener, so we would, you know, basically the door would be opened and we'd run outside. It's funny, like over the lockdown years, and I guess even before that, you would hear people talking about, oh, in the olden days, the house, the door to the house would be open and the children would be let run free, and then you wouldn't come back until it was dinner time. And that's how it was. And now, these days, it's very different for lots of different reasons. But kids don't really have that anymore. Many of them. Anyway, so I'm of that generation. I was born in 75, so it was late 70s, early 80s. And I just was, maybe because my mum is a gardener, always hands in the dirt, digging, planting, and that whole cycle of life was very, you know, it has always felt like such an integral part of me, and I feel very connected to how that cycle works. You plant something, it germinates, you harvest it, you consume it, you compost it. And you know, and but anyway, so you were asking me about trees and humans. So I you know, I was the eldest. So for those, and my sister is 1 year younger than me. So yeah, having that time outside was, that's the place I go back to when we've been having salons and we invite everybody to think of where's your favorite place, where do you feel most safe and happy, your happy place. I always go back to lying under those trees that were in the hedges. And of course, they're not there anymore. They were chopped down to build a motorway.
I know that it's different for kids growing up these days for a lot of reasons, but I was wondering if you thought, had any thoughts on how rural Ireland itself has changed. And the motorway was actually a really interesting segue to that question. Do you think someone growing up right now could have a similar experience to yours, or is it harder now?
Well, my sister has twins, Aoife and Heidi. I actually dedicated the book to the UK-Irish edition in the acknowledgements. This edition of the book is dedicated to Aoife and Heidi, who just turned 10. They're also Virgos. They turned 10 in September. And, you know, they, Shelley's married to an English guy, Nick, and they lived in Bristol for a long time, and they just moved to Dorchester during the lockdown. So they have a huge garden, and Shelley's kind of fallen into my mum's footsteps and has now become an avid gardener and is completely addicted and hooked. And that's how they live. They open the door and they're out in the garden and they sow the seeds. So it's, and I think it was very important for Shelley because she also has those memories that I have. She doesn't have the same memories, obviously, because she's a whole other person. But those, that specialness, having that access to the outside was so important. It's why she, I think, wanted to leave London because that's where they lived for like 10 years. Really needed to have that outdoor space. So I feel like Aoife and Heidi are getting that, but they also have the screens and they're kind of addicted.
Yeah. Yeah. We're familiar with that as well. Yeah. Our son who's 8 years old. How did you, where was the line, no pun intended, from your experience with the outdoors to drawing and writing? When did you become interested in those mediums and how are they connected for you?
I think, you know, so my mom was a gardener, and that cycle, the organic, probably, and my mom's mom was also a gardener. So that lineage probably goes that way inside of me. But then my dad was, you know, worked with numbers, was an accountant and a mathematician, and because I was the eldest, tried to, or imagined maybe that I had that capacity that his brain had for numbers. So I have those memories of sitting down with a blank piece of paper and a pencil. My dad loved working with pencils. And I can still remember, you know, just the magic of watching him make a mark and write the numbers. And he was so excited. He loved this magic and how it worked in that system. Because mathematics, right, is like a man-made system. And it makes sense. Maybe if you could understand it, my brain isn't wired the same way. But I think, and we had a lot of encyclopedias, and so spending time and atlases, because my dad actually worked for Avis for a while when he was younger and drove through the Sahara and was in Japan a lot, so had atlases of the world. So I spent if I wasn't outside, in my memories, when I was little, I was inside with these huge books, navigating the world through the words and the images and diagrams describing the planet, basically, I think. So in a sense, you could say everything that I've done since is very much related to those, you know, to my mom and dad and their interests and what they shared with me.
That's cool. My dad, this is like sort of a tangent, but my dad was a huge baseball fan when I was younger. Now he's kind of disillusioned with the sport and being kind of like, you know, very corporatized and all the new stadiums and stuff. But he loved going to baseball games. And there was the program that you could keep score in yourself, was like, had a little line for each of the outs in each of the innings. And there were these like coded little lines that he would draw based on what happened in each play. And they were like, when you were talking about your dad, with the markings, it just totally reminded me of that. And they're quite similar to the ohm lines in a lot of ways. Like they're like up and down and a couple sideways lines. It's like these diagrams of like, oh, that was like a line drive to second base and then out or something like that. But he used to love writing those, following along and writing that. I bet he kept a lot of those old programs too. Sorry, those are my personal reminisce that you just reminded me of there.
And that logic made sense to him. He could read it in it and yeah, understand what yeah. it said. But to somebody else, it would be completely incomprehensible.
Totally. Yeah. It was a code. It was a language. Yeah.
You mentioned really briefly in passing the Sunday salons that you've had. And I believe those were conversations or are conversations that you have in your home with different artists and activists around things that are happening in the world. And I'm interested, you know, especially in the time that we're living in right now, how you see the role of art in activism, because, you know, I've been following you and your work since I first learned of you. And it's something that a lot of artists talk about, but you seem to be really, really connected to.
Yeah, it's so problematic, right? I remember going to college. I went to NCAD and did an Erasmus exchange in my third year and went to the HDK, the Hochschule der Kunst in Berlin. Now it's the UdK. And this was a big topic at the time, artists who were activists and doing social work. And it was very looked down upon if you did that kind of work. People thought that artists were doing it in order to get funding, because the government was giving out lots of grants for groups who were working with communities and doing socially engaged work. So I was really young. Like, this was when I was still a student and I didn't even really understand what art was, because I went straight from secondary school to art college. So I thought Van Gogh, you know, and Monet, that was contemporary art. So it was a huge learning curve. But that was the beginnings of my understanding, thinking, being told by those around me that this was not something that you wanted to do, which was confusing to me, because most of my work was happening outside of the studio and through conversations with people. And very quickly, I realized that this was what I do. Even though I was in the painting department, it didn't make sense to me in any way to have a large canvas and oil paints and brushes to make an artwork in that way. Just felt so disconnected from my reality and what I was interested in. So the work was always happening outside in conversation, in real time, in a way. And I think time is something that's always been very important to me. And trying to understand the world, because essentially that's what my work is, trying to understand not necessarily who I am, but where we are, because I think the individual, and that's something that more and more my work has gotten really interested in. I guess like all of us, we're realizing that we aren't really individuals. Like, this microbiome means that there are more non-human parts of us. Even this morning, I was reading Philip Ball's piece that he just wrote for Nautilus. He has cancer and he's got a new book coming out. Anyway, this is a little tangent, but talking about the cells, and I've been looking into cells with the recent work for Emergence magazine. So thinking about how do we fit into this planet? Because everything that we know is on this planet, right? Everyone, as Carl Sagan said, everyone that we've ever loved this is what exists in the whole universe, as far as we know. It's all on this one planet. And this connects to, you know, my dad having all of his travels. So when I was little, hearing these stories and seeing the maps of the planet and using my finger to move across countries, you know, line drawing my way around the planet. But everything exists on this one rock that's in outer space. Yeah, so realizing that, so I came to realize, okay, my work, it's, there's a lot of pressure to be in the studio when I was at college, but I said I got to be true to myself because this is what I'm learning. And so I guess this is where I got went off on the tangent that for me, the work is about trying to understand things. It's questioning. Maybe that's why I've always felt like creating printed matter in books was an important part of what I do, because it's a way to share that information, because it's about learning myself, but having conversations and sharing and asking questions. I try to never call the work political, maybe because I did have those negative connotations and had always been told, oh, you don't want to do that, because then you're not, you know, a true artist, you're a social worker. But in, I guess, after the 2016 election, it's nice that we're having our conversation today on election day. I have to switch my T-shirt when we go. I can't vote, but I'll go with my partner, Dylan, to vote. And I have another T-shirt that I wear for that momentous moment. But when the 2016 election happened, sort of imploding or exploding everything that I had understood about the world, I guess that's when it was, there was no question what I was doing was political, because everything kind of fused in that moment. Like, I just saw atom bombs. That's what I saw when I heard the news in the middle of the night. It was just like the end of humanity. It marked the end of our species in a way, and most of life on Earth. It was this momentous thing that had happened in a horrific way. And it just felt like, well, we've got to fight this, or I have to fight this, because it's wrong. And it's wrong to attack people and communities. And that's what was happening every day. So, you know, at that time, I did have a little studio in the West Village, even though I don't usually have a studio. But I would go into the studio and just sit there in the dark and end up just making a sign, a protest sign for whatever issue was happening that day, and would just rove between protests. And that kind of became a full-time job. And it was just because I had the privilege of being able to step away from work and be in the streets shouting and opposing whatever vicious thing was happening in the moment. So in that sense, the politics became overt, because, you know, there were pictures of me being shared and I felt like I had to share. So I was documenting the protests that I went to, and the lines blurred completely. But in a way, my work had always been about all of these issues, but in a more invisible way, because I didn't feel, even though I knew, you know, my work's always been, I think it's always been about the climate emergency, even before we had that language to talk about it. I've always been really, and I think that's why I came to New York. I came here on a Fulbright scholarship to look at our relationship with nature in the city. And obviously that leads to where we are now, humans on planet Earth consuming, and where is that leading us to? But I felt like we had enough time that I could do it, not in an arty way, because that sounds ridiculous, like I'm just trying to make art, and I never always avoided trying to make pretty pictures, much to my mum's chagrin. But I think I did, naively, I thought that we had enough time that I could ask these questions and work around these issues, thinking, well, you know, even Jim Hansen, when he spoke to Congress in the 80s, thought, well, it was going to affect his grandchildren and it was going to happen in the future. And now that's all come smashing down, you know, just in the last year or two, we're seeing these storms, like every day there's another emergency. And it's so obvious that we've broken the planet, the climate system has changed completely, and we're in big trouble. And I think this is personal, this is for me, if I don't speak about it, I do feel like silence is complicity. And not speaking about it is, we just don't have time for that at this point. I frankly don't understand why everybody's not outside in the streets screaming. I guess it's because they're busy trying to go to their job, make their money so they can pay the bills. You know, we're like hamsters in a wheel. really, and everything's spinning so fast, it's very hard to get out of that cycle of just trying to take care of yourself and your family. And maybe because I am an artist, I have the privilege to be able to like hop out of the loop and go, wait a minute, this is all completely crazy. We've broken everything and we're running out of time. I don't know if that answers it, but it's a bit of a spiel.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. And related to that, I first came across your work through the Irish tree alphabet online. I don't remember how that kind of came into my knowledge, but it's beautiful and I loved it. I was reading an article in Emergence magazine where you were talking about the alphabets that you do. And you said, I want to create living alphabets, stories we can plant to literally make words matter. Can you talk a little bit about what this means to you, the idea that language is broken? This was part of the inspiration for the title of our podcast, Dyed Green. So I'm particularly interested in your perspective on this.
Oh, great, because I wanted to ask you about the title. So I look forward to hearing that story. Yeah, so that all happened in the early stages of lockdown. The Irish tree alphabet was a project I was supposed to do while I was home in Ireland. I was planning on spending most of 2020 in Carlow, working for Visual, the large art space there. I had visited in 2019, done a site visit, and was working with Emma Lucy O'Brien, the director there, very generous, and was really excited to do, because it's a huge space. I don't know if you visited it. I think it's technically the largest visual art space in Ireland. So it was very exciting. But then, you know, obviously 2020 came and I got stuck of all places in California. So I was very far away from Carlo. But we decided to go ahead, even though with the lockdowns, we didn't know if my show was scheduled to open in the summer. And so all of the work happened virtually. So the exhibition concept sort of completely changed in a way, because I thought I would be working with local community groups and with actual real trees. And instead created the Irish tree alphabet. And I had already made the what I call the tree alphabet for this book that I'm waving in the air right now called About Trees. And when I got this book, this was in 2015. So it was obviously the build up to the 2016 election. And I think that, so those salons, so all of this was happening at the same time. We started the Sunday salons at our home in the end of 2014. And so at that time, right, because it was built up to the election, so there was all this campaigning, and that monster whose name I can't repeat, who became so-called president, was, you know, twisting language and truth into pretzels. At some point I actually was making pretzels out of newspapers. But it was so, the horror, you know, and it was so vile. Because language is precious. It's what we have as humans to communicate. We're storytelling creatures. We use, you know, I started thinking about the alphabet as this, it didn't fall out of the sky, right? These 26 little letters didn't just magically appear and sprout out of the ground. Ta-da! We're letters. You can use us. They evolved over like millennia. And they, these letters, in different cultures, represented animals, plants. And so the forms that the letters take correspond and visualize, they're like pictograms in a way, something that they refer to in real life. So the alphabet is a man-made invention, but it's so related because we are humans, we're on this planet, we're connected to everything else. So it shows, I think we've disconnected from this. Maybe we should try and remind ourselves when we're teaching kids the ABC, you know, with these baby board books, if we could somehow show how these letters, where they actually come from, so they don't feel so disconnected. Anyway, so all of this sort of erupted in a split second in my brain in the middle of the night. And I thought, oh, I could make a tree alphabet with these tree drawings that I had made 10 years before when I first moved to New York. And that's what I did. I replaced each letter of the alphabet with a tree and made this book about trees. And it was just it was a way to celebrate the beautiful planet and beautiful community and how rich it all is. And honestly, it was like a time capsule because I wanted to do it to celebrate my 40th birthday. I didn't tell anybody. That was a secret. It was my personal greedy act of wanting to try and encapsulate. So 40 years on the planet, thinking through time, how can we celebrate all of this beauty? And trees seem such like, you know, it's an iconic, a tree is iconic, and most cultures use them to celebrate. And also talk about the connections with humans. We're planted and we're grounded and we're rooted the way trees are. But we also exist in community, like forests. We share and we help each other. So I made the tree alphabet so that with my tree drawings, they turned into a font. So you can download the font and then type and translate with trees. And everything in the book is translated into forests. And as soon as I got the book in my hand, I realized, oh, we could actually have a planting guide if we used trees happy to a specific place. It could become a planting guide that we could use. And because I was in New York and had already worked with the Parks Department on a tree museum project, the forester, Bram Gunther, at the time he heard about my tree alphabet, and we had a meeting, and he said, let's make a New York City tree alphabet, and then we can plant, you know, it would be like an ABC that you could actually plant with. And so that happened 2018, 2019. And of course, I wanted to make an Irish tree alphabet. That was the inevitable, obvious one. And maybe I would never have made a tree alphabet if it weren't for the OM and that Irish, you know, tree alphabet. And so 2020, that was when I made the, what I call my new Irish tree alphabet, which is complicated because it has the English language, the Irish names for trees, English names for trees, the OM, and then my drawings and trying to decide which tree gets connected. So it was like a twister, mind bending, and having to do it all virtually, you know. So it was, and it's just my version of an Irish tree alphabet. Somebody else could make another version.
Max has a follow-up question, but I just wanted to make a comment since both of you have had tangents. This is something that just popped into my head while you were talking about doing this project for your 40th birthday. I have like a very specific memory of when I was younger and my mom turned 40. Somebody gave her like a card or a refrigerator magnet or something like that that said 40 isn't old if you're a tree. And so I just wanted to say that.
That's great.
Seems like it fits here, but yeah, it's a nice thought as we continue to get older.
I love that. Oh, I wish I'd known.
That's could perfect. Have made
like that the bookmark.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, if you had a secret 40th birthday, you still have that opportunity, right? No one needs to know.
Yeah, maybe for my next momentous.
Yeah.
Because the years are going by so quickly. I'll suddenly be 80.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
I'm curious, the way you speak about language in general is really reminiscent. We did have Manka and Magan on the show, and we've spoken to him at length about how Irish speaking, about how the Irish language, words in the Irish language contain meaning that don't map to words in the English language, and how it's possible to express things in the Irish language that are not as easily expressible in English. And I'm just wondering if, as you were working on your language, you saw any parallels or any connections to the, you know, resurgence and the renewed interest in Irish speaking and the growth anew in the Irish language as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, Mancon and the work that he's done has been so vital, so important. He's really tapped into isn't really the right phrase because maybe he created this, or maybe it's just, he's the right person at the right time, but there's such a need for it. And I think this is a global need, right, to remember. And I hope that my book, The Language of Trees, helps with this. There's a real need for us, right, humans, our species, to remember where we came from, to remember our creation stories, and to remember who we are. And this suddenly, it's like a sudden realization, like, and it's related to what's happening now in Israel and Gaza. And I don't want to go into politics and have that conversation because that's like horrific and traumatic. And I'm no expert. But the fact that humans have, as soon as I said that, then I had these horrific images pop into my mind. We really have this need that we need to remember who we are so that we can find the right way forward. It's like we've fallen off the track into a crevice, right? And we've completely gotten sidetracked with these horrible people. And I don't want to be sexist, but most of them do happen to be men, so who've completely kind of corrupted and are trying to corrupt minds. And it seems to be pure greed and power. So that side of humanity is really ugly. And it's unfortunate that they're the minority, but they seem so loud that they took up all the airspace. But to try and remember the goodness, the heart of who we are. And I think that always seems to, if you're clear-eyed and really questioning it, you remember the indigenous folk and the people who were here before, right? So before the corruption happened. Not that they were perfect, right, by any means. And so for my book, it felt really important that I include Indigenous voices. And I think in Ireland, it's so, the country is so, like, on the scale of things, it's so teeny tiny, right? Ireland is just this tiny little rock in the Atlantic Ocean. But we all know that there are hidden stories, like almost every rock has a story to tell. And you've got Tim Robinson did all of his incredible work where he literally almost mapped parts of the West and remembered those stories. And so Mankon's work, reminding us, and he's got the Irish language. I unfortunately don't, because we moved when I was 10. I don't speak Irish. I can just say on Will Cadigum Dulgachy and Leris, sadly. And that's another crime, right, that we don't have our language, and you see it happening in other cultures where it's kind of beaten out of you. Anyway, back to...
But in a lot of ways, I feel like you're maybe doing similar work with, creation of language to express certain things in certain ways that maybe we can't express in English, for example.
Well, okay. I think with the tree alphabet, it was just really important for me to offer a way to decenter the human, right? Because of all of this keeps going back to the fact that us humans, we've placed ourselves at the top of the pyramid of life on Earth. Like, we can do, and you could read the Bible in a super creepy way, like we can do whatever we want, have dominion over plants and animals and dig it up. And that's kind of what we've been doing. And to realize, wait a minute, we are just one of the many millions of animals on this planet, and we all need to share and live together. And I think that's why remembering and having these conversations with the Indigenous communities who are really connected with your community. Like, my book opens with Winona LaDuke's essay on the Ojibwe New Year, and the new year starts when the sap rises in the maple trees. So you have this intimate connection with the land, with your home and your community and the people and the beings that you live with. And so to try and break that disconnect that somehow happened to us. And so a tree alphabet was my gentle way of trying to say, wait a minute, us humans, we're not the only ones who communicate and who have stories to tell. If only we could slow down and listen, the trees and basically everything else here, they're all communicating. We are just too ignorant. We're not capable, because our species is so young, right? We're just a baby, really. We don't have the skills to be able to tune in and understand what all of these other species are saying And so that's where science comes in. You have people like Suzanne Simard and others who are letting us know, well, actually trees, they communicate this way through the mycorrhizal network. And rather than competing with each other, they actually share and work in community and harmony. That's why I wanted to have the forest on the cover of the book, to show the trees aren't these isolated beings. So that's how I was taught when I was growing up, that they all fight for light and minerals, and the tallest one will win and beat out the other ones. It's not like that at all. They actually share and help. But yeah, the language and the trying to remember, I think, you know, also when I was little, we weren't taught much of these Irish myths. It was something that was kind of disregarded or hidden or looked down on. It was something that maybe old people were into, or crazy people. I think there's a lot much more respect now, and a realization that this is actually really important for our culture and who we are. And you can only know who you are if you're really grounded and remember.
I think what is interesting to me, and to go back to the name for our podcast and kind of tie it to Ireland and to trees, is Dyed Green. It was actually Max's idea, but it was inspired by the Chicago River, which unfortunately is dyed green every St. Patrick's Day because some people think it's cute and funny or something. I don't really understand why that still happens, but it was meant to also suggest sustainability. And sustainability is another word, you know, that currently kind of either doesn't really mean anything or it means something different depending on who is using it. And so the idea of dyed green also is meant to connect people to Ireland. The word green comes up for most people when asked to describe Ireland, but you wouldn't really know unless you started to scratch the surface that Ireland actually uses a lot of nitrogen fertilizer. And that is a large part of the reason why the fields are, that everybody knows, are green all year round, and the different shades of green. But also another thing that people don't really think about or know about Ireland and Ireland's history is that it was once at least 80% forested. And certainly people don't think about forests when they think about Ireland. They think of these fields, and it's sad. It's sad when you think about all of that kind of shifting baselines, and just the lack of trees is kind of one of the things that maybe defines Ireland's environment.
And this connects so much with what I was just trying to say about trying to remember, you know, who we are and where we come from, because we had forgotten that Ireland, the West Coast, the natural ecosystem is rainforest, temperate Atlantic rainforest. Who knew? It was only recently, I don't know if you've had Owen Dalton on.
No, but I've read his book, yeah.
Yeah, so Owen and Ray O'Fukla, Darren Clare, realizing and showing us that, wait a minute, you know, this ecosystem is temperate rainforest. That's how disconnected we are from our home, that we didn't realize. So now there's this huge movement, and I think the rewilding campaign that's been happening too, there are more and more people who are doing what I've been trying to do for decades, get a little plot of land and let it do its thing, let the trees come back. And obviously we can't do that everywhere. That's a whole other political conversation, because we do need food. But yes, to remember that this rocky land was once forest. I've used the Irish tree alphabet to make this, to write that sentence on a few spaces. I did it here in New York at the Irish Art Center. This was once forest, because it's the same here in Manhattan. Manhattan was mostly all forest, and Eric Sanderson has recreated that online virtually. You can fly over any address here in Manhattan and see the forest that was here before. Yes, well, thank you for telling me what that. Those were exactly what came to mind when the title Dyed Green.
Dyed Green is our podcast, but we also have a culinary tourism company called Bog and Thunder. We saw Bog and Thunder as sort of reclaiming the dis, for lack of a better way to talk about it. I am really interested in also is how important bogs are for the environment. I believe that they're a bigger carbon sink than the Amazon rainforest, which most people don't think about. The word bog doesn't really have, as much of a negative connotation, I don't think, in the United States as it does perhaps in the UK and Ireland, but I've definitely heard the word bog used as a euphemism for a toilet, which is really unfortunate given how precious they are to the planet. In 2019, you co-founded an organization called Friends of RD Bog to help protect a peatland area in County Louth. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that particular area means to you and how it's threatened and maybe where we are today in 2023 in terms of protecting it.
Yeah, so it's so true that words, that little word bog, it has so many negative connotations in Ireland. And it's shifting now. I think the last couple of years, there's been a huge shift, and maybe it's connected to what we were saying about Man Con and this bringing back the Irish language and a respect for the myths. And I actually, for my very first public artwork, I think it was my very first public artwork that I did in the art college in Berlin, was part of a bog awareness series that I did in RD. That's the town. When I was 10, we moved to RD in County Louth. So RD, Dublin, and Berlin, those three places I traveled when I was a student. And this bog awareness project combined my drawings, my conversations with people, meeting musicians who turned my drawings into music and performed them outside the public toilets in the art school. And so it was humorous, right? It was a joke. It was meant to play on that word bog, but I shared photographs that I had taken in the bog. So it was also a way to show how beautiful it was, to try and play with the word and the language and the meaning and the place. But it's funny. So that was in 1997. So all those years later, I ended up back in 2018, really grappling with what was happening. The Irish government and the local Louth County Council wanted to build this motorway, and the plans for it had been buried for about 20 years. So it was something, when my dad was still alive, we were trying to understand what was happening with this motorway that they said they were going to build right through the edge of the bog in peatland. And it didn't make any sense to any of us. And it was very difficult to find out what was happening. And then it sort of disappeared. So that would have been in the 80s. I guess, or 90s. Yeah, around when I was doing all of that work. So it went quiet. The plans for that road disappeared because, you know, the country had no money. There was no money to build roads and bypasses. And then, so 2018, the plans resurfaced. Minister Shane Ross at the time got money from the EU. And at the top of the pile was this RD bypass. So he literally took it off the shelf. I think this is exactly what happened. He just took it off the shelf and said, okay, let's go with this. And one of the ministers was from RD and was on the, I don't know if I should name names, everybody who's local will know exactly who I'm talking about. He was on the minister, he's the transport minister, the transport committee, fiercely trying to do everything in his power to push this through. And it's so corrupt and wrong in so many ways. And we don't have time, and I don't want to go into the nitty gritty, but I made a website for our group, Friends of RD Bog. It's rdbog.org. So you can see some of the information where we try to explain why it's the wrong road in the wrong place at the wrong time. It just doesn't make any sense to build a road through a peatland. But they could have gotten away with it back then. If they'd had the money, they could have done it and nobody would have blinked. Well, we would have been upset because we live right there. But now, right, there's so much information, like you just said, that we're realizing that peatlands actually store more carbon than rainforests. We were actually, when we started Friends of RD Bog in 2019, it was just me and Fiona and a few other locals. We were using this phrase saying that, you know, the bog is our rainforest, because that was 2019. It was before we realized Ireland had actually its own rainforest. So that's how quickly we're discovering things and really seeing our own land and country and landscape for what it is. It's like we've been blinded for so long and suddenly, you know, the veil is falling away. So anyway, we were calling the bog our rainforest because it's true with the sphagnum moss, which is the bog builder, absorbs so much carbon. And it's beautiful. The reason I had all of these photos, the first works I made from the bog awareness series, were because it looks like a brown smudge, and a lot of people are very dismissive of bogs because they think there's nothing there. It's just this dead zone. But when you actually look closely, you'll see it's full of jewels, sundews, carnivorous sundews that Charles Darwin wrote about. Like a lot of people don't know, Ireland has these carnivorous plants, and bog cotton and asphodel, and it's just, yeah, it's really beautiful. And it's also very quiet. It's one of the few spaces when you walk into a bog, it's like sound and time and everything slips away and you're just in this timeless quiet zone. So I think that's why I would go and spend a lot of time there when I was, so I have these early memories, right? The ones that I'd shared with you before when I was, would have been 8, 9 with the trees in Longford. And then afterwards, after 10, when I moved, the next memories were lying in the heather in the bog in RD. And so it was a very special place to me. And I discovered my neighbours felt the same. So that's when we got together to form Friends of RD Bog as a way to try and understand what was happening with this mysterious road project that we weren't being given any information about. The government was just trying to quietly build it. And so we started a movement in a way. I think with Friends of RD Bog became this kind of a spark or an ember or a catalyst for other community groups, and through social media, you know, I started the website, and the website's very useful and everything, but it was really, I think, when I started the Instagram account that it really kind of exploded, because then you can directly connect with other individuals and groups locally, super locally, and then more around the country, nationally, and then internationally. And this recent movement, right, in recent years, to share information and knowledge that we're, you know, now understanding about bogs and peatlands, how precious they are. And the one in RD is really unusual because it's the most easternly bog in the country. Most of them are found in the Midlands, near where I grew up, actually, in Longford. That's really the bog where people expect bogs. You don't expect them on near the coast. But it's curlew habitat. We have curlews where we used to until they started building the fencing for this illegal road. And so we are in the process of taking the government and the county council to court. And actually today was the latest date for it's a JR, a judicial review, for the judge to see the case. And got the message that they've postponed it because they've been doing this for the last 2 or 3 years. It just, each time the judge sees the case, he postpones it for another couple of months. But the next, the date they postponed it to is actually over 3 days. So this seems serious, like they're finally going to actually discuss the case. And it's going to happen in April, the 9th to the 11th of April. So hopefully I will be home and I can be there. We're not sure what it means exactly, because these politicians have been so conniving and really, I think it's not too harsh to say, evil and doing illegal things. It's absolutely criminal and despicable what they've been doing to try and push this through. And it's just been a small group of us getting together. Like, people power is real. So, but they've already, you know, they illegally went in and dug up, a man with a digger went and dug up. They removed like kilometers of hedges and trees, bits of the landscape, because the hedges are the bits that have been around for so long. Tore them all up, destroyed, murdered, slashed, chopped, whatever, removed them all to put in this fencing, marking the route of where this road is, they want to put it through the edge of the bog in peatland. And it floods. So we have these gorgeous photographs that show the fencing completely submerged in water, because that's what happens. It's a flood zone. So, and actually one of our members of the group had to go out and rescue the man in his little digger because he sank into the flood waters. The whole thing is, you know, it would be funny if it wasn't completely this horrible. So that's the state of play right now. And I've felt very strongly that what we were doing with Friends of RD Bog was related to the rights of nature movement that's kind of sweeping the globe, different communities. In different countries all over have been gathering, coming together to create rights of nature included in constitutions to try and protect ecosystems, mostly bodies of water. So it started in Ecuador. And then we had the Citizens Assembly in Ireland, was that last year, the year before, where the group of 100 people came up with over 100 recommendations to the government, including rights of nature, and hopefully there'll be a referendum on that. And so I felt very strongly, it seemed obvious to me that this is what our group was about, rights of nature showing. And rights of nature is about rights of us, right? Because we are nature, humans, and communities. And if you're protecting your local ecosystem, it's about protecting your family and your community, because you need safe drinking water. You need trees. You need bog. We need all of this in order to live and thrive together. I was suffering from COVID and long COVID at the time, so I just had to step away. So I technically stepped away from the group. I'm not doing everything that I was doing for years.
I mean, there's so much value in being able to be there and to sort of help kind of like birth an organization and create a space to help create a space for people to come in and join and get involved and even recognize that some of these things are happening. So
it was way too much work on top of everything else that I was doing. Like, it was crazy. I don't know if that's why I got long COVID, because, you know, I wasn't sleeping and I wasn't there in real life because it was the travel ban. I couldn't travel, couldn't be there. And that's hard if you're not there face to face, because this is all about dialogue, right? We know that growing up in Louth, you're in border county, so we've seen with the Troubles, you really need dialogue, conversation. These issues don't just magically disappear. So I think the fact that I couldn't be there to have the conversations, because I think there was the fear, oh, you know, the local farmers feel if the bog is given rights, then that means they don't have the humans can't use their turbary rights, the rights to dig up the peat, to heat the homes during the winter. Whereas the reality is it should all, you know, it's very, very easy for me to say, it's very easy to see how it should all work together. It's the same way they're trying to the just transition move away Port Namona from being a peat digging, you know, digging up the entire peatlands in the middle of Ireland, to just transition where you have suddenly can create what they call green jobs. This is another dyed green and sustainability. You have to be really careful what they actually end up doing. But yeah, you really have to be on the ground listening, talking, and that's where conversation comes in at the local level.
This is all super interesting, and we're running close to our time, but we wanted to talk about the book, The Language of Trees, before we ended our conversation. It's such a beautiful book, and I know we've been talking around a lot of these issues, but we wanted to ask you if you could share about the book itself, the process to come up with the idea and how long it took to put together, as well as the response that you've been getting and the reactions to it.
Yeah, it's been sort of a long journey in a way, because it started, I mentioned before, this book about trees that I made in 2015. So the book, The Language of Trees, that just came out this year, at the heart of it is this book about trees. So I could give that longer version of the story, because I could just say, oh, we made this and it came out in April. But anyone who knows me knows that I've been a lover of language and books. I'm a visual artist, but I've always worked with language and created printed matter that usually was free, that people could take away whenever they visited exhibitions and projects that I did. And then, as I said, I wanted to create something, a secret project for my 40th. So that's when I made the tree alphabet, and there's the tree alphabet and the tree typeface. I don't know if you could hear, but that's the feeder just feeding my cat. She's not gotten used to the time change, so she's been hungry for the last hour. So the book about trees was a way to kind of celebrate trees. And now that's what I say about this book, The Language of Trees. It's about trees, obviously, but it's really about humans, right? Because we, and what I should say is it's made up of, it's like a compendium. So there are about 50 or 60 contributors. So in a way, I'm kind of cheating, making a book that I didn't actually sit down and write myself. And not that I feel like a fraud, but I have spent most of the year on a book tour, and I kind of am a fraud, because I'm not like all the other writers that I've met at the festivals who sat down and they did that hard work of writing the whole book. I kind of stitched it together or wove it. Maybe I'm more like a weaver, and collected a lot of different material. Some of it has been published before. Some of it was new, was commissioned for the book. And all of it hopefully tells a story about who we are, where we are, what we can learn from trees, what trees can teach us, what we can teach each other. And this recurring notion of tree time, that hopefully if we slow down and we could listen to trees, if we could just really slow down, we could learn to maybe live better, be better lovers of the world. I think that's what it's all about, is love for each other, love for community, love for this precious planet. And so hopefully the book shares some of that, because that's really why I made it, I think, was to try and make a difference. I was supposed to have an event at MoMA in September, and the curator kept describing me as being on a mission. I'm on a mission. And I think it's like connected to what I was saying before about this political work. Like, we don't have time, honestly. And Rebecca Solnit's book, actually, Not Too Late, was published on the same day. I'm holding up the Irish UK edition. This is the American edition. So this one came out first on April 4th, which was also the day that he was in trial. He was arraigned. And so the helicopters were flying in the sky. We had the launch in the Elizabeth Street Garden in Soho. So yeah, Rebecca's book came out, Not Too Late. And I feel like this is a partner book in a way. So yes, it contains a lot of other people who were so generous to share their work with me. And I feel like I've been lucky, you know, throughout my life, a lot of my projects have happened that way, through other people and through their voices. And we're all about sharing and caring.
The language of trees is like, I'm just thinking about as I'm talking to you, that it feels like what I imagine what one of your salons is like, but in book form. It's like a conversation with people about trees and between people about trees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. Cause that's, yeah, I think that's exactly, cause when I made the original one about trees, 2015, that was right when we had just started the salons, and some of the people in it, the book, were part of the salons. So there's definitely that overlap. And I'm glad that it does feel like that to you, because that was the, I guess, part of the intention, was to create something that did feel inviting, like you are part of the reader is now part of this community as well, and that the threads, the conversation and the stories could lead you off on tangents, and you could discover something. Or you could feel like you could contribute. I hope that it's open and inviting enough that people feel like they can contribute themselves to the story. And because the typeface is available, the font is there to download, people are invited to write their own messages as well. So it's kind of like a never-ending project. Maybe a lot of people feel like this when they make a project. Oh, it's never-ending, it's going to live on. But somehow this really does feel like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I Max makes fun of me because I say this sometimes, but I do feel like we could just sit here and talk all afternoon. But I wonder if I could ask you, unless this feels a little bit too overwhelming or too soon, because you're still kind of on book tour, what's next for you? Do you have another project that is evolving or you're working on, or will you be digging deeper into the language of trees in the future?
Well, I actually have to dig into the PDF, because we're working on another edition. So I had to open the PDF yesterday morning and do my first little testing and send it to my editor. So I should get a reply from her today, hopefully saying that my test worked. So then I'd be free to go ahead on that. But I'm also, you know, I made a series of drawings for Emergence magazine. I was working on them last year when I was really trying to understand the long COVID, whatever was happening with my body. I had hoped that by now it would be gone, but sadly it's not. So I've been with a lot of doctors. So when I wasn't on book tour, I was with the doctors trying to figure it out. I have dysautonomia, which means my autonomic nervous system is dysfunctioning, is broken. And the autonomic nervous system is what takes care of things that should happen automatically, like your breathing and your heart rate and your neurons firing and your blood pressure, stuff that you don't think about. So it's very strange to be in a body that's now not able to do those things properly. So yes, that's, I've been working on trying to fix that and learn to live with it. And I think I'm going to revisit those emergence drawings in that project, because it's looking more inside of myself, which I think mirrors what's happening on it, you know, inside the universe. So that's one project. I'm actually going to be in conversation with Kerry and Marshall Farrell. I don't know if you know Marshall's book, Uprooting.
No, I did see your Instagram post yesterday, I think, that I shared.
Yes.
Yeah,
I didn't know. So we're having that conversation on the 30th of November. I'm really looking forward to that, because I'm in the middle of Marshall's book right now, and it's really, there are so many parallels with Camille Dungy's, a contributor to About to the Language of Trees. Camille, her book Soil, that just came out. So, you know, people who are gardening, because that's another project I've been trying to do for decades, is get my little plot at home in Ireland and be there. So lockdown, like for many people, has kind of upended things and made some things not possible. So that's been delayed. So yeah, the work continues as ever. It's the artwork and the real life living work is all intermingled. So trying to fix my body and understand the dysautonomia. So it was something I had never even heard about it until the doctor said, like, diagnose me and use that word. And I was like, what? What's that? Because everything starts with drawings and research. So I'm in that phase of that work. But yes, the book continues. It will have another life. I've even been using it, because this is the backside of my US edition. So the front is the forest and the back is End Fossil Fuels at protests and rallies. So outside of MoMA, to ask them to divest from their fossil fuel funders. So that work continues, they're protesting and campaigning. I guess that's never ending. And going off to vote now.
This was a really, really fascinating conversation. We really appreciated your time and being able to get so deep into some of these subjects, which I know I do make fun of Kate for saying it, that we could talk for hours, but in this instance, I agree. And we could definitely keep talking for hours, but we'll have to have you back on the show sometime and continue the conversation.
Thank you for having me. It's been difficult because, you know, this book tour has been incredible, so rich, and I feel really lucky and privileged to have spent so many months traveling, you know, across here in the UK and Ireland, having these conversations about this book. It's been really, really incredible, so special. And despite being ill, like at the beginning, I thought the publishers were crazy trying to organize a book tour. I said, are you serious? There's no way. Even sitting upright is difficult for me. How on earth am I going to do it? But we did it. So the whole thing feels like a miracle.
Amazing.
That's great.
Well, congratulations. And thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Until the next time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Dyed Green is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Dyed Green is a project of Bog and Thunder, whose mission is to highlight the best of Irish food and culture through food tours, events, and media. Find out more at bogandthunder.com.
We'd love to hear from you. If you have any story suggestions, questions, or things you'd like to share in response to our broadcast, you can email us directly at dyedgreen@heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.